Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's start out with some really good news for those of us with arthritis. In fact, I am definitely going to be incorporating this, contemplating it for a while, but I'm definitely going to be incorporating this in my practice. This is platelet-rich plasma therapy for osteoarthritis, particularly knee osteoarthritis. This study was published in the journal Regenerative Medicine, a peer-reviewed journal, and it showed that a single injection of leukocyte-rich, platelet-rich plasma, and we'll explain about that in just a moment, improved functional mobility, pain, and quality of life after 6 weeks. Now, the thing that makes this study really important is, of course, it was a placebo trial. Another thing about it was that it gave people trackers. They had a motion tracker, so it wasn't just I feel better. It was actually that they were moving differently, like a regular modern sports watcher tracker. It tracks your activity, it tracks your movement, and it can say something about how you're walking and how long it's taking you to shift in space, and those are important factors. Previous studies on platelet-rich plasma have been kind of inconclusive, and part of that may just be because they were having people use a pain scale, and it was their subjective impression of if they were improved. And honestly, if it hurts, it hurts, right? It's very difficult to grade pain, and we make an effort to do so, but the data is really murky. Something like an objective measurement of actual movement works much better. So what is platelet-rich plasma anyway? It's actually a biological product produced by your own body. And in order to get it ready for injection into the knee, the doctor would draw your blood. And we're talking about 8 cc's. So that's about one regular blood draw tube when you go to a lab and they check your bloods for a physical or something. That's one tube worth of blood. That tube gets spun in a centrifuge. And as it's spun, the components separate rather like a jello parfait, where you have a layer of red blood cells at the bottom, and then you have a layer of platelets and white blood cells, and then you have serum. And the trick is to get a few white blood cells, but mostly platelets, because platelets are rich in growth factors. That makes sense, because when there's an injury, the platelets are the first thing on the scene, and their job is to essentially pile up where the blood vessel is leaking to prevent further leakage. And hey, we want to get the healing started, so they release healing factors. Those healing factors are going to summon fibroblasts and get the tissue ready for healing. Meanwhile, of course, back at the coagulation cascade, the platelets release chemicals, thromboxane primarily, that leads to the formation of a clot. There are these free-floating proteins in the serum that when they are stimulated and cleaved, they turn into Velcro, and they attach to each other and form a big wad between the platelets, and you end up with this mix of platelets and protein spider silk, really, holding the whole thing together and keeping the blood from leaking out. This clot also releases factors that trigger the migration of macrophages, which is to say big amoeba cells that are going to eat up the clot over time. And we're on our way to healing. First, we patch the leak, and now we're going to start healing it. So if you take the healing factors and you insert them into the knee, they have pretty potent anti-inflammatory effects. They aren't going to rebuild cartilage. We're not making any kind of stem cell claims here. But they do shut down the inflammation of osteoarthritis and improve function. And if we can get a person with arthritis moving, then we actually, with that movement, help nourish the joint and increase the production of the lubricants that help the person move. And so you start to get into a good loop. So as I said, I'm going to be introducing in my practice, and I hope that other doctors will follow suit. I think the science is now ready to lead us forward on this. And all you really need is a centrifuge and the knowledge of how to do a decent intra-articular injection. Of course, there is, with any time you stick a needle in a joint, you better be sure that you're doing sterile procedure, because you definitely want to prevent any infection. We're going to run through a series of technological breakthroughs, new devices and other components on the market, or I should say not yet on the market, but are coming down the pike pretty fast. Many of you are familiar with monoclonal antibodies. If you watch commercial television, you've certainly seen ads for monoclonal antibodies for rheumatoid disease, but especially for psoriasis, because that's a bigger market and therefore worth the television costs. Monoclonal antibodies are one of the new therapeutic tools that we are just beginning to really use. In fact, Regeneron, that is currently being given in people who have COVID, is often given as an outpatient in our community for people who are sick, but not so sick that they have to be in the hospital, but sick enough that they could benefit by literally an infusion of monoclonal antibodies. And that's what we're doing here, is making antibodies to order. And the possibilities are amazing. We'll have another story about monoclonals and malaria later in the program. But right now, we have some well-established drugs that are used for autoimmune and some cancers very commonly and very successfully, but they have to be given by injection. And wouldn't it be lovely if we could give injectable agents orally? Well, a team of engineers at MIT, working with scientists at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a insulin company called Novo Nordisk, are working on an elegant alternative delivery strategy for large molecules. They envision a day when a person could simply swallow a capsule that was basically a tiny machine containing the drug that would then home in on the lining of the stomach and inject the drug directly. This recent study, furthering research done by these same researchers, they've already established that they can deliver insulin. The reason that insulin is so important is obviously a great many people take insulin injections. An insulin pill is something like, well, among other things, it's a big pharma holy grail, because you would get so much better compliance and buy-in from people. The monoclonals, like insulin, cannot be given orally because the enzymes in the digestive tract break them down before they can be absorbed, so they don't get absorbed in their actual functional shape. Kind of like if you get the car mail ordered to you in 50 different boxes, it's not going to be a turnkey operation. In 2019, they developed a capsule that would inject up to 300 micrograms of insulin. That pill was about the size of a blueberry and had a really interesting thing going on. It had a high, steep dome on one side and was relatively flat on the other. The design was actually inspired by the leopard tortoise. And just like a tortoise can right itself if it rolls over onto its back, the capsule, with just the oscillations of the stomach, it will orient itself if it gets flipped upside down so that its little needle can be injected into the lining of the stomach. Now, the stomach's a lot safer place to inject, to put a needle, because it's a big, thick, muscular organ. It's a hollow organ. It is thicker than the bladder, and so you can't punch through that wall very easily. Whereas the intestine is a much thinner-walled thing, and if that needle got in there, you might conceivably puncture the intestine. So they've had to figure out the needle problem as part of the development. The first version of this had a needle made of compressed insulin, which would embed itself into the tissue of the stomach and then dissolve. And then, of course, along with it were the 300 micrograms of insulin in the reservoir. The new pill, however, can hold more. It can hold up to 4 milligrams, which is enough drug to cover most of our injectables. So this is really interesting. The new drug is basically a reservoir shaped like a leopard tortoise, and it contains an injection needle and a plunger that would push the fluid out of the capsule. But both the needle and the plunger are glued in place by a pellet made of solid sugar, which is ironic if you're going to use this to deliver insulin. When the capsule gets into the stomach, it's very wet and moist in there, and the sugar pellet dissolves. This causes the needle to push into the stomach lining, and the plunger pushes the liquid through the needle, sort of spring-loaded. And then when the capsule is empty, there's a second plunger that pulls the needle back into the capsule. So now it'll detach from the stomach wall and can safely continue on its merry way down along with all the other oral contents to finally exit the body and find its way into the sewage system. They've done this in pigs, and in pigs they were delivering a monoclonal antibody called Humira. They were getting levels that were similar to those achieved by injection. This is used to treat inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis. And they also were able to deliver a type of drug called a GLP-1 receptor agonist. We talked about these drugs, Victoza being one of the brand names that you may see. These injectable drugs are used to treat diabetes, and they have a good track record of helping type 2 diabetics lose weight. And recently, a big study came out showing that they can help obese people who are not diabetic lose weight as well. This is very exciting. The problem is the cost of the drug is about $2,000 a month. So getting that afforded by most people is sort of out of reach. And it's an injectable, so there's a lot of consumer acceptance to be overcome. If this could be reduced to a daily pill and we can get the price down, it may turn out to be the ultimate weight loss pill. So there's a lot of drive to get this technology developed. So they used pigs. So after several days measuring the blood levels, they were sure the Humira was getting in. And they also then took an endoscope and went down and looked around in the stomach lining of the pigs to see whether the injections had left any evidence of injury. This is looking good for a new technology to allow injectable drugs to be delivered by injection internally by, well, effectively little robot syringes. And I'm finding that very exciting. Our next story is about another kind of robot, throwable robots. This story comes from the end of June. You'll remember that horrible condo collapse. I've been waiting for a moment to squeeze it in. It's, you know, a little off topic, I guess, if you think of it, because we're talking about disaster rescue. But, I mean, saving lives is saving lives. So in that situation, it's very difficult to find people who might still be alive or find air spaces. There's a company called Teledyne FLIR who has built these throwable robots. They look like little toy tanks, and they have thermal sensors, cameras, two-way radios, and they relay information back to search and rescue operators, and they're basically operated like drones. They also have another robot called the PackBot, which can shift loads of 40 pounds. That's, you know, decent. So you could send that in there to move rocks and then send the little tank in to take a look. They both need to be operated by an operator, so they're not autonomous yet. But clearly, that's a matter of scaling and time. I can imagine in the not-too-distant future, particularly if we continue to have so many disasters, it does seem like they've increased, doesn't it? Anyway, I can just imagine a pack of little robot hounds being just, okay, throw them all in there, and you throw in 30 or 40 of these to explore the burning building or the collapsed building and make sure that you've gotten everybody out or at least identify where to be searching for survivors. Really interesting, and I'm looking forward to more fun technology there. I mentioned another monoclonal coming up, and here it is. An antibody treatment for malaria. Scientists at the National Institute of Health have developed a monoclonal antibody treatment that can potentially protect against malaria for almost a year. As I've mentioned, monoclonal antibodies can attach to anything. You build a human antibody that will not be rejected by the immune system as foreign, so it reads as human, and then you put it in there, and its target is up to you. So proteins, it can be used to target proteins. It can be used to target sugar molecules, complex shapes, and of course, the Plasmodium falciparum, the parasite that causes almost 500,000 malaria deaths a year. So they had a small group of people who were exposed to malaria-bearing mosquitoes. 15 of this group were bitten. There were 6 who were in the placebo group that were bitten. 5 out of that 6 got malaria. Of the 9 who had been given the malaria monoclonal, none of them developed malaria. So that's pretty protective. The monoclonal antibody is now going to be studied in Mali at a larger scale. But, you know, the way you could use this is similar to what we would do with the flu vaccine, right? There's a flu season in the United States, and when we get to flu season, we vaccinate our vulnerable people. In malaria, you'd be targeting these monoclonals to children, particularly infants, and pregnant women who do much worse with malaria. And you could essentially lead the malaria season, which is obviously the wet season, and really get on top of malaria elimination campaigns, because the fewer people who are acting as reservoirs for those mosquitoes, the less malaria you're going to have to deal with. And those mosquitoes don't fly very far. So they pick up their malaria locally and spread it locally. So this is a decent strategy. I like it a little bit better than eliminating the mosquitoes by making them sterile, something that's being tried in Central America and may have some unintended consequences for the food chain, or at least I'm a little worried about that. We've heard of being scared like a rabbit. Well, it's not just humans that suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a growing body of evidence that shows that near-death experiences will have a long-lasting effect on wild animals, including epigenetic effects. A recent study on snowshoe hares in the Canadian Yukon, whose population rises and falls along with those of the predators, you know, biology 101, guys, that's one of the classic examples that they use. Well, the hare's feces will give you a measurement of the cortisol levels, also the sex of the hare. So what they showed in the study is that when the predator populations are high, the mother hares have elevated levels of cortisol. The high cortisol mothers have fewer litters and their babies are smaller. What's even more interesting is that the female babies also have high cortisol in their feces, even though they did not directly experience any fear. They themselves were in utero at the time. So this is really interesting, and it speaks to the epigenetic transmission of anxiety, something that's already been demonstrated quite well in mice, and now we're seeing it in a wild population. And this is significant because it's not in a laboratory and it's a genetically mixed population, which means it's more likely to generalize across the board to mammals, which means be nice to any pregnant woman you see. Be nice to your pregnant wife. Be nice to your pregnant sister, because the reducing stress, making life easier, is going to result in stronger, healthier offspring who will be less predisposed to anxiety themselves. It's interesting because a lot of folk wisdom talks about protecting the mother and how adverse events while you're pregnant could lead to adverse pregnancy outcomes. Turns out that folk wisdom, which was laughed at for a century, has some elements of truth to it, as much folk wisdom does. Another study, not just mammals, turns out that female song sparrows who were exposed to recordings of hawks in a forest had 40% fewer live offspring than those who were not stressed. So why so? Think of the biological investment to create eggs and chicks, right? If there's a low probability of survival because food chain issues, lots of predators around, all you're going to do is feed the hawks, well, maybe you want to hold back some protein and some calcium and some supplies so that you'll be able to, you won't be depleted and you'll be able to produce a stronger litter down the line or a stronger, I guess it's called a clutch of eggs. I'm not sure if that's true for sparrows. I think it's true for chickens. So we'll just have to go with a stronger clutch of eggs, stronger litter of offspring, all because of the biological signaling between the environment and the offspring. Very interesting. Many women with breast cancer in their families have for years had the option to get tested for mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2 to determine if they have a higher risk for the disease. But now doctors are warning that, oops, we found a third breast cancer gene. It's called PALB2. And the risk of breast cancer for women who have mutations in PALB2 is almost as high as it is for those with BRCA2 mutations. Unfortunately, most of the genetic testing that was done between 2014 has not tested for this gene. So women who were tested, who have a sister with breast cancer, a mother with breast cancer, maybe even two or three relatives who were tested negative, now need to go back and make sure that they were tested for PALB2. And it makes sense that this would be a risk factor gene, because really for BRCA2 to work at all, it needs a partner. And that partner is PALB2. So if you have a germline loss of function mutation in this, you have an increased risk for breast and pancreatic cancer. And carriers have about a 2 to 4-fold increased risk of developing breast cancer compared with the general population, which starts to get into the territory that we see with BRCA. So if you've got a bad BRCA and a bad PALB2, your risk for breast cancer is even higher. What does all this mean? Well, it means that you need to find out if you have this particular mutation. Anyone who has done a 23andMe and can download their raw data can search for the most common version of PALB2. And I'm going to say this slowly. So by now, if you want to write this down, or you can go to the podcast, askdrdon.com. Just go and pull the podcast next week. The number is RS18017710. So that's what you're going to be searching for in your 23andMe raw download to see if that's present. If it is, none of these commercial products are perfect. It is important that you get confirmatory testing, but the presence of that would indicate that you definitely should spring for the confirmatory testing. A doctor should be able to write a prior authorization to get your insurance, your health insurance, to pay for it. I hate those, by the way, because they're being reviewed, you know, by people who don't understand the science at all and have a checklist of criteria that don't really fit the clinical situation. But I'm trying to just breathe and accept the things I cannot change. That's my mantra for the last couple of weeks, because there have been a whole lot of things to accept. I don't have to list them for you. A few others as well. So let's all take a deep breath and accept the things we cannot change. I'm looking forward to reading an email. This from Kathy from Capitola. And Kathy wants me to comment on the iMask Plus protocol. And those of you who are long-term listeners to the program may remember an interview we did back in the late spring of 2020. And this interview was with one of the doctors who developed the Math Plus protocol. I believe it was at the last show in May, but I can't confirm that. The Mask Plus Hospital protocol was developed very early on by a bunch of doctors using their brains to postulate that certain small studies that were coming out in the medical literature in the spring, things that were sort of off-the-cuff, best-guessed therapeutic strategies being done at various hospitals, not placebo-controlled particularly, although sometimes randomized to usual care and the special intervention. What these doctors did was they went through those studies and they agglomerated them and they made some extrapolations on things that are shown in other studies of hospital pneumonia and long-term ventilators to be useful, and they put together the Math Plus hospital treatment protocol. And this was later revised to include ivermectin in October of 2020 after additional data came out on ivermectin, but that discussion did not occur in our original, and they've added a few other things as well. I'm going to tell you about the hospital treatment protocol first, even though that wasn't Kathy's question. The idea is if you are sick enough to be hospitalized or you have an abnormal chest x-ray, we're going to give you a steroid. Methylprednisolone, not dexamethasone, was what they suggested. But realistically, that's sort of like, do you want your peanut butter chunky or not chunky? They're very, very similar agents. Really no substantial clinical difference between these two forms of steroids. They also gave high-dose vitamin C, up to 1,000 milligrams orally every 6 hours, or if they were requiring high levels of oxygen or in the ICU, 50 milligrams per kilogram every 6 hours. That worked out to about 3 grams every 6 hours for someone of my size, which is about 60 kilograms. So, you know, a substantial amount, but not really anywhere near toxic. However, the vitamin C has antioxidant protective benefits that there was evidence would be helpful. They also gave them IV thiamine, heparin, and this was very early that they started suggesting the use of anticoagulants, and that was later majorly validated and has become the standard of care. Ivermectin, as I said, added in last October at 0.6 milligrams per kilogram per dose and given orally. Fluvoxamine, which is a serotonin drug. Cyproheptadine, which was given with that. And antiandrogen therapy, like the dutasteride or the finasteride that are given for men with prostate hypertrophy, but only in men. Antiandrogen therapy seemed to help men have better survival. High-dose vitamin D being given, and this was in their initial recommendation. Later on, they added atorvastatin, which is a statin to lower cholesterol, but it also lowers inflammation. And as we all know, cytokine storm, that was a problem. They also gave them melatonin, zinc, famotidine, or Pepcid at very high doses, which also showed some benefit in fighting COVID in some of these early hospital trials. So they put together a protocol. They promoted it. It was science-based. It had a big reference. And as I said, I interviewed them. I thought it was super interesting. And I did advocate for the adoption of their protocol. This was before we had Remeron or Remdesivir or any of the other agents that subsequently emerged. Then Kathy's question came along, and I re-evaluated, and I see that they have posted a second protocol, and this is called the iMask Plus for prevention and early outpatient treatment of protocol for COVID-19. And this was what Kathy was interested in. So we're going to start with their prevention protocol, and it is ivermectin at 2 milligrams per kilogram twice a week. This was for chronic prevention. And then if you got exposed and knew you had been exposed to someone with COVID, it was twice that much, 0.4 milligrams per kilogram, as soon as you figured out you were exposed, and then again in 48 hours. They also used antiseptic mouthwash, relatively high dose vitamin D3 at 3,000 units a day, vitamin C at 2,000 milligrams, so 1,000 twice a day, quercetin, which I love because it helps block the furin enzyme on the surface of cells that actually activates COVID, and their dose was 250 a day. zinc at 50 milligrams a day, and melatonin 60 milligrams before bedtime. When you get into melatonin at that level, you're getting into an anti-inflammatory level of melatonin as well. And of course, again, reduced inflammation, but not so much that you've created immunosuppression. Now that's their prevention protocol. Their early treatment protocol is something I can get more behind because I feel that the risk-benefit and the social justice parameters for early treatment make more sense than, and I'll explain why in a minute or two. But their protocol, ivermectin at a little bit higher dose, an agent that I don't know about called nitazoxanide, the same sorts of things that they were suggesting in the hospital, including monoclonal antibody therapy, which really only works in early treatment protocol. So that's why often the hospitalized patients don't get the monoclonals because it's too late, and plenty of data has emerged showing that if you don't get them in early, don't bother. Save the stuff for the next guy. So lots of vitamin D, big doses, lots of vitamin C, same doses of quercetin, melatonin, and of course, wear your pulse ox. To comment on the ivermectin piece, which is very much on people's mind, I worry about ivermectin. And of course, Fauci made a very negative speech about it last week, essentially calling it horse dewormer and actively discouraging any use, and pretty much making it seem like medical heresy for any doctor to even consider the use of ivermectin. You know, it bothers me when things get politicized and when we're not looking at science facts. And I think there's enough science facts to suggest that ivermectin does make a difference in early COVID that you're kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater there. But the problem is the bathwater is full of misinformation, people thinking that ivermectin twice a week at a low dose is somehow going to protect them from COVID. What are the adverse consequences of promoting ivermectin as a protective agent, as preventative? Well, number one, it's not established that it is. The data is not convincing. There is one small double-blind placebo-controlled study, a lot of anecdotal study, and a lot of unpublished stuff and published stuff that showed it doesn't work for that. There are also some really substantial adverse consequences here. The first one is, if you say that ivermectin works for prevention, then people who are vaccine adverse or who are concerned about the vaccine, even though the Pfizer now has the FDA approval, they'll find some other reason not to take it. It discourages vaccination. If people think it protects them, then it's viewed as a viable alternative. It isn't. That perpetuates the epidemic and leads to excess deaths. The other problem with promoting it for prevention is that it creates a massive demand surge on a generic pharmaceutical, which cannot scale up to meet that demand. So what happened is that the ivermectin supply dried up majorly, wasn't available pharmaceutical grade. So people started using the veterinary, lower grade, non-pharmaceutical quality substitutes. These are not watched as carefully. These are potentially more dangerous, and they're harder to dose because they're designed to be given to horses, which weigh a lot more than I do. And people are going to screw up on the dosing, and they're going to take overdoses. And if they're taking them every day, which I'm sure many people will start doing because it's like, well, if twice a week is good, then every day must be better. And they are probably going to end up with some excess morbidity from liver problems and drug interaction issues. I keep hearing, oh, this is a completely benign drug. Yeah, it's benign when you give one dose once for pinworms. That's when it's benign. Is it benign when you take it every day? No, it's not. Comparing this, because you can use it in kids, therefore you can use it at higher doses in adults over a long period of time, that betrays a really poor understanding of physiology. So thank you for the question, Kathy. And I do want to tell you my policy is I basically don't talk about COVID unless I'm addressing a question or something really major has happened, because I feel like there's so much other wonderful stuff going on in science and health right now that's getting neglected. I try to keep an open mind about these things. I try to be a science-based independent thinker, but to quote one of the Marx brothers, Groucho, I think, I like an open mind, but not so open that my brains fall out. Yeah, let's talk about brains falling out. This is information I received from one of my patients. She sent me a number of papers. I pulled some links for the purpose, because the thing about the ivermectin really made me think about the stuff that was going on backstage in science, where we were testing out an idea, and then we would see if the idea would fly, and then we would perform the idea in rehearsals, and we would see if it still worked, and we'd have a dress rehearsal with the FDA, and then we'd release it as a therapeutic agent. Well, them days are gone forever, because now we have hundreds of gentlemen and gentlewomen scientists reading with varying degrees of expertise and motivation, scouring the medical literature and the scientific literature on topics such as cancer. And so this is the tale of fibendazole. It's another dewormer. It's used in labs often to treat rodent pinworm infections because, you know, if your lab animals get pinworm, it's going to screw with your data. So they don't grow. So now we've got to fix them. This paper came out in 2008. I will just say that these were mice that were in an experiment looking at lymphoma. So they were given standard diet, a diet with vitamins, a standard diet with fibendazole, and the vitamins and the fibendazole. So what they found was that when they put the tumor cells in, if the animals had gotten vitamins before the implantation of the tumor and received fibendazole, there was significant inhibition of the tumor growth. This was in 2008. It was one of the very first papers reporting this effect, and it subsequently has kind of took off in the alternative world, and there's a lot of good in them thar hills. So I'm not putting down alternative medicine. However, alternative medicine plus the internet can be a pretty scary thing. The next article I found was an article from a private alternative cancer care organization talking about their special protocol. And their special protocol, among other things, includes things like a statin and metformin, and also mebendazole. Now, they chose that over fibendazole because it has similar properties, and it's actually approved for use in humans. And I have not had a chance to look at the literature, so I'm not going to give you advocacy or not on this. But the assertions on this protocol page suggest that it might be useful. And indeed, there has been, I think, some additional evidence that it might be useful. This study was looking at metastatic prostate cancer. It was an in vitro study in glass, unbiased, phenotype-based, green identifies therapeutic agents selected for metastatic prostate cancer. Basically, what they did was they had a bunch of different cell lines of metastatic prostate cancer. They looked at the cancer cell lines, and they used computer properties to go through a drug library and look for drug candidates, and they tested them. And fibendazole was one of the winners, showing preferential cytotoxicity and programmed cell death. So it worked well against the cancer cells. Another dewormer, albendazole, worked a little bit better than the mebendazole. And they also found that this drug worked for mice that were implanted with cancers that were resistant to the usual drugs. So that was quite attractive to think about using these in cancer. But again, this was not in humans. This was an in vitro study, suggesting that further study is needed, and maybe we should use the mebendazole or the, I don't know about whether albendazole is approved in humans. That'd be something to look up. But you'll notice the azole bit there. We can't keep these drug names straight. It seems like people were smoking something when they made up these chemical names. So we always have the same endings, and that helps us look smart and polysyllabic without going absolutely insane. Just saying. But as I said, internet, right? So here's a case report. This was published quite recently in the 2021 Journal of Case Reports in Oncology. And this was basically a woman who had small cell lung cancer, and she was pretty desperate to try to find something. She was getting chemotherapy, and the doctors were monitoring her, and they noticed that she got very, very severe liver injury. It was after 9 months of chemo, which is strange. So, she's been taking fibendazole for a month because of the social media reports suggesting it's effective for cancer. No way for her to calculate the dose, so she probably was taking the animal dewormer dose, and it damaged her liver. There have been numerous other reports, and it's pretty much the same story every time. This isn't approved for humans. Somebody finds out about it on the internet. They find out that they can buy it from the veterinary medicine. I have this prepper book that I bought, God, it must be 30 years ago, about how to score all the drugs you'll ever need for your survival cash from the vet stores without having a medical license. And of course, I think I was just out of medical school when I got that book, and I remember thinking, well, there might be some useful information. You know, it was the Reagan years after all, so I was expecting an apocalypse. But hey, my apocalypse didn't materialize, or rather, I should say, maybe it's just been delayed. Let's move on. Some more feel-good stuff. Breast milk proven to enhance heart performance in premature babies. Now, when the baby is in the neonatal intensive care unit, they're born early, so the mother's breast milk may not have come in effectively. That can be fixed, by the way, by giving her doses of prolactin, and maybe we should be doing that. This study of 80 preterm infants showed that higher exposure to their mother's own milk had enhanced cardiac function at 1 year. One of the problems with prematurity is that there is a lifelong increased risk of cardiovascular disorders, including heart attacks, heart failure, pulmonary and systemic hypertension, and a higher risk of death as a result of cardiovascular disease. When we look at the hearts of young people who were born early, we find some interesting variations in the actual anatomy. The volume of the ventriculars is smaller. They're shorter in length. The systolic and diastolic function, in the case of systolic, that's the contraction. In the case of diastolic, that's the relaxation so that it can fill again, were both impaired. And the muscle mass was extra large, which of course requires extra blood flow, which because of the anatomy of the heart actually doesn't happen very effectively. So an overgrown heart is more likely to have a heart attack. So you get impaired heart function that's quite different from an infant that's born at term. And this dysfunction is detectable at the time of hospital discharge. And if you go and look at these babies when they grow up and they're teenagers, you still see these same changes in their heart. This is not feeling very good. This study shows that if you exclusively give breast milk in the first months after birth, a lot of these traits will normalize. The higher the proportion of their mother's own milk during the first few weeks after delivery, the better the right and left ventricular heart function and structure were. The lung pressures were lower, and there was an enhanced stress response comparable with children who had been born at term, whereas the babies who were fed formula were definitely the ones who had these persistent changes that we can infer, although this study only followed them for a year, that the babies who improved are probably going to still be improved as teenagers. Another story about health in teenagers, a new study around the history of concussions and multiple concussions in young people. So this study shows that athletes with a history of concussion may show more brain injury from a later concussion. And it goes into some of the details about this. And we're talking about football, volleyball, soccer. So volleyball is not necessarily a contact sport, but concussions do occur. And often we send the person back. As a doctor, I evaluate them. They're neurologically intact. They don't have any symptoms. Sure, you can go back and play. How long can I keep them out? Well, maybe we need better guidelines, because when you have a second concussion, even if your first concussion was years earlier, there are some subtle and chronic changes in the brains that can be seen structurally. So this study was using type of functional MRI to look at blood flow in the middle part of the brain. And that's the part that's especially vulnerable to concussion because it gets stretched with a concussion. And stretching is worse than smooshing. They looked at blood flow in the cingulate cortex and the white matter of the corpus callosum. That's a big cable system that connects the right and left half of the brain and is really important for coordination and multitasking. So changes in blood flow and microstructure show up on these brain scans that are very subtle. We haven't had the technology for showing this very long. So they looked at 228 athletes, average age was 20, 61 with a recent concussion, 161 without. And within that first group with a recent concussion, 36 had a history. And in the second group, 167, 73 had a history of concussion. So they got the recently concussed athlete, and then they took five brain scans from the time of injury to 1 year after returning to play. 1 year after that recent concussion, those with a history of prior concussion had persistent declines in blood flow in that cingulate cortex. And we're talking about a pretty big difference, 20% difference, 40 milliliters of blood per minute per 100 grams versus 53 in the average person. Lower blood flow to the brain means lower efficiency and lower functioning of the brain cells that are fed in that area. So what we saw was that repeated injury really makes a difference in this blood flow, whereas those who had a recent concussion without a history did not see this kind of decline. Since it's persisting for a year, we have to essentially assume that every concussion causes cumulative damage. Now, those of you who are, like myself, interested in holding on to as many brain cells as you can as you age, want to be really careful about avoiding concussions, wearing those bike helmets, maybe thinking twice about the rock climbing ventures. Certainly don't rock climb without a helmet. I used to do that. Children don't do that. Adults don't do that. We got to protect our noggin. Turns out that the old, you know, hit them in the head with the club and once they wake up, they're fine. I think it's just not so. And brain aging is something that needs to be limited as much as possible. Well, I always like to have a story about cancer. This new study examines the Achilles heel, they are calling it, of cancer tumors. But it also gives us a chance to talk a little bit about solid tumor physiology. So these researchers are looking at trying to limit progression and growth of solid cancer tumors. And solid tumors are a big lump of tightly packed cells growing, getting bigger, and not responding to the normal controls and inhibitions that crowding out the other tissue would ordinarily cause on something that started growing. They've turned off their ears and aren't listening to mission control. But they need a blood supply to grow. And as the tumors grow, the blood vessels can't keep up with them. They can't provide oxygen and nutrients to every part of the tumor. It can't diffuse into this tightly packed cells. Like a compressed sponge, it can't absorb very much. So you get these areas of low oxygen. What happens then is the cancers switch their physiology and they stop using their mitochondria and they stop being efficient and they start burning glucose through a process called glycolysis. This is what you do when you overwhelm your glycogen supply and you overwork a muscle and it's sore afterwards because you create lactic acid. Well, the lactic acid could stop the tumors from growing. So they have an enzyme called carbonic anhydrase 9, and this breaks down the acid, actually turns it into bicarbonate and CO2. So that's really helpful. Bicarbonate and water, my bad. The cancer cells need this enzyme. So finding drugs that would inhibit it would be an excellent strategy. And they found a tumor inhibitor that is in phase 1 clinical trials. They've shown that it is helpful in breast, pancreatic, and brain cancers for suppressing tumor growth. But in this study, they went further. They wanted to see if not only could they suppress growth, but could they kill the tumors. And what they found was that these cells, these cancer cells, also accumulate iron. And this leads to a thing called ferroptosis, or death from iron overload, I guess. The cell membranes become weak and rupture from too much iron. We have iron storage diseases ourselves. They're called hemochromatosis, so it's interesting that cancers have an iron storage disease. Anyway, the new drug plus giving iron might be a very, very substantially positive strategy. There also apparently are some drugs that lower the threshold for ferroptosis. So we may be looking at a completely different way of targeting cancer cells based on their own physiology, with agents that already exist and quite likely have fewer side effects in normal cells. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.